You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 90, Social Media and Mental Health. You're listening to part one of a two-part series on social media and mental health. This is a live recording of an event that was hosted by the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences and the Faculty of Science at Carleton University, where Dr. Jim Davies, Dr. Kim Hellemans, and Dr. Andrea Howard explored what research really says about social media's impact on youth mental health. Today's episode explores topics like the psychological underpinnings of social media reward systems, whether it's possible to be addicted to social media, and practical methods you can use to avoid getting sucked into social media against your will. Part 2 will release on July 1st and features discussions about the efficacy of the recent bans on phones and social media in educational environments, the role of parents and governments in dealing with this issue, and social media as a coping mechanism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to tonight's presentation. I'm going to be asking some questions here about social media, youth, and the science of well-being. I'm going to introduce myself, and then I'll turn it over to our two guests. My name is Dr. Jim Davies. I'm a cognitive scientist here at Carleton University, and we will start with Kim, and then Andrea.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Dr. Kim Hellemans. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience here at Carleton University, and my research explores substance use health, stigma, mental health and well-being, primarily among emerging adults, university students, but I also look at other demographics as well as the general public. And I also have a PhD student whose work is on problematic social media use, so looking at social media use through the lens of an addictive behavior. I'm also one of the associate deans of science here at Carleton, and my portfolio is student recruitment, wellness, and success, so I'm heavily invested in understanding what promotes student success at universities, including how their mental health and well-being influences their academic performance.
Hi, I'm Dr. Andrea Howard. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Psychology here at Carleton, and I'm also the director of the Pickering Center for Research in Human Development. I study adolescent and young adult well-being, different areas including social media, substance use, mental health, and that is as far as I prepared my introduction, so I'm going to just
Back to Jim. Thank you so much. All right, we'll get started with some questions here. I know I'm very interested in this. Let's start with talking about studying social media. Social media is incredibly popular. I hear lots of opinions about whether it's good or it's bad or anything like that. Scientifically, is this a difficult thing to study?
Yes. I think it's really hard to study because you're not studying like an object or a solitary event. You're studying an entire environment. So social media isn't just an app on your phone, it's a world that you're entering, and there's incredible diversity in the experiences that people are having online. So things like what we've typically relied on, counting up the number of hours that you spend on a particular app, on multiple apps, and trying to relate that to mental health and other indices of well-being, is a very, very incomplete picture. One of my colleagues compares it to something like you don't study the roots of obesity by measuring how long people sit at the table in front of food, right? It's a much more complex problem to study than just kind of, are you using it, are you not using it?
And I suppose if the answer were clear, we would already know what it was, right?
Yeah, I think for the most part, a lot of the disagreement is over how we're approaching the study of social media and well-being, and whether we're asking the right questions, whether we're using the right methodologies. And I think there's been a lot of backpedaling and a lot of reevaluating the methodologies we're using. So we're in some ways kind of starting over once we've realized we've made a lot of mistakes in approaching the topic.
And would you say that the overall evidence is in favor, opposed, or mixed?
extremely mixed and extremely preliminary. Yeah. Kim, you might have more to say on that.
Okay, well, let's talk about, before we get into some of the downsides, somebody want to comment on some of the positive aspects of social media that scientists have found?
I think there's a lot. Entertainment, networking, social relationship building, creative expression, and then what comes up a lot is for marginalized youth having a place that they can go where they're welcome when they might not be in their face-to-face lives. So lots of potential positives for sure.
Okay, so some people say that they are addicted to their cell phones or addicted to social media. Is it possible to be addicted to cell phones and social media?
So first thing, before I get to my answer, I like to know who I'm speaking with, just so I know the depth of my response. So I'm just curious, if you can put up your hand, let me know if you're a member of the Carleton community in some way. Students, staff, amazing. So we got lots of Carleton folks here. Somebody outside of the Carleton community, yay, okay. How many scientists in the room, however you define that? Wonderful. And how many are you here because you're curious about your own use, or your the use of your child, adolescent, teen? Okay, good to know. Okay, so before I answer like whether social media is addictive, it's important to define what is an addiction, right? And it's important to state that I'm a neuroscientist. I come at this from a neuroscience background and perspective. I also have a PhD in psychology, so I have a grounding in psychological principles. And it's important to recognize that nobody agrees upon a definition of what addiction is. Scientists, researchers, clinicians, physicians, no one agrees upon that definition. A definition that I adopt in my classroom as I teach and what informs my research is an addiction is a loss of control over reward-seeking behavior. And notice I use the term reward-seeking, not drug-seeking, because as our understanding of addictions has broadened in the last 20, 30 years, we're starting to recognize that you can develop addictive behaviors to things that are not just substances. So when I grew up as a baby neuroscientist in the 90s, we only looked at things that were substances and we only called those things addictions. So cocaine, heroin, alcohol, nicotine, they can all lead to what is the phenomenon of an addiction. Addiction is not a diagnostic term. We only use that pejoratively. The diagnostic term is literally alcohol use disorder, opioid use disorder, nicotine use disorder. It is a so-called substance use disorder. We are starting to recognize, and by the we, I mean clinicians and scientists, that, like I said, behaviors can become addictive or develop. You can develop these behaviors that resemble addiction to things like gambling. We all know that you can develop these problematic behaviors as it relates to gambling. So you can have a gambling disorder, which is now included in the Diagnostic Bible for Mental Health Disorders as an addictive-related disorder. Gambling is the only one that's included in there. We are starting to recognize that some behaviors even outside of that, like eating. So binge eating disorder is starting to be recognized as possibly having similar features to a substance use disorder. And now internet and gaming disorders is being included in this Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders as something to look at, because we are seeing that people are developing these problematic behaviors, particularly with internet gaming. The other one is like things like sexual behaviors as well can be included in that framework. What about social media? So again, I want to qualify this, that it is very, as Andrew was saying, the research is very preliminary, but as what we are starting to see is that people can develop behaviors that resemble what we see with substance use disorder. So what does that mean? Tolerance, right? And when we take substances, we need more to get the same high. In the same way, people develop tolerance or can develop tolerance to their social media consumption. So I need to be scrolling longer to get that same feeling of satisfaction. Withdrawal. So people who consume substances in large quantities can develop withdrawal symptoms if they stop taking that substance. So things like a hangover, you wake up the next day, you have a headache, you feel anxious, your heart is beating, that's all part of withdrawal. In the same way, there are some folks that report if they take their cell phone away, right, and you're not allowed to scroll, they feel irritable, sort of on edge, a little anxious. So again, some of these features are what we would put under that addiction framework, but it is all very preliminary. The research is in its infancy, and what my PhD student, Holly Shannon, who can't be with us today because she's in Portugal, poor Holly, what her research is really looking at is also the neurobiological mechanisms of social media behavior, because we know no matter what substance you may be developing an addiction to, so whether it's alcohol, nicotine, cocaine, cannabis, you have very similar changes in the brain that alter specific circuits that relate to reward behavior, stress mechanisms, thinking, preoccupation. And what Holly's research is looking at is, do we see those similar changes in the brain of people who develop what is called problematic social media use? So that's the term that we're using. So again, we're not saying social media addiction. We want to kind of move away from that terminology. But there are certainly populations of folks that can develop these problematic social media behaviors that resemble what we see in substance use disorders. It will never be to the same potency to what we see with cocaine, alcohol, etc. But certainly there are people who have problems, I would say, with their social media use.
Yeah, I'd love to add to that. I'm really excited to hear what Holly's gonna learn, because those concepts like tolerance and withdrawal are physiological responses to drugs. And that is, measuring that is very different than asking somebody on a, say, a 1 to 5 scale, do you feel irritable when you don't have your phone? So another piece to that is, I'll stick with the measurement theme. If you ask people about things that they do a lot, like social media is the one we're talking about right now, but if you ask people, say, who are involved in competitive sports, you could ask them similar questions. Do you feel irritable when you're not allowed to practice hockey? Do you feel an urge to do it more and more as you become more involved? You can add those numbers up and get a score that in related research has shown to be correlated with things like other problematic behaviors in other areas. And so we have some concern that what we're able to measure in terms of problematic social media use isn't necessarily getting at what we really think about when we're talking about like addiction the way you think of it colloquially, and that we can measure with physiological responses. So, you know, that's a piece that I'm concerned about.
So it certainly seems like the social media companies are trying to get us addicted by trying to maximize engagement, and they're constantly doing studies without ethics approval, of course, on us trying to get us to maximize our... I just mentioned that because we were put through the ringer to do anything, and they just do it all the time. They're trying to make us maximize the engagement. What are some of the tricks that they use to, some of the things that they end up doing to get us to stay on our social media apps as long as possible?
So I just want to acknowledge that the people that they hired to develop these apps probably have PhDs in psychology, because they know what is required to keep people there. So think about when you're engaging on social media, what are you doing? You're doing this, right? Does it ever end? No, right? So the endless or infinite scroll is a feature that is designed to keep you there. There is literally no end or no pause. You're just endlessly scrolling. And that is definitely something that is a feature of psychological manipulation to some extent. The other one is variable ratio reinforcement. Any psychology majors in the room?
Yeah, right?
So variable ratio reinforcement means that you're not given a reward every single time you engage in a specific behavior, right? And we know from animal models back in the 50s that if you get a rat in a chamber and you're pressing on a lever, and that lever might give you a reward after 10 presses, maybe it's gonna give you it after 15, maybe 20, you don't know, you're just gonna keep pressing because maybe it's this one, right? And in the same way, social media apps are there to give you variable ratio reinforcement or even variable interval. So it's the number of scrolls or the number of likes, and it's the on average the amount of time that you're on these social media apps. So we know this from the addiction literature as well. These are the hardest behaviors to extinguish. I always talk about this with like a sweat dating apps, right? Like it, or date online dating, right? If you're sending out messages every once in a while and then you're getting a response on average every 3 texts, that's keeping you thirsty. You're gonna keep maybe this answer, maybe this time, right? So this is what keeps us engaged. This is very much manipulating those parts of the brain that are involved in motivated behaviors. Autoplay. Right? And I'm not on TikTok. I don't watch Reels on purpose because I know what the research says. But the fact that they just keep going and they'll keep pumping the next video, again, there's no stop mechanism. Jim would know this as a cognitive scientist. To stop behavior is a much more effortful than to sit back and just let it play and feed forward. It's also personalized content, right? I've heard it said that TikTok knows me better than I know me, right? So the fact that the algorithm is designed to maximize what you like. They are literally measuring how much time you're looking at an ad, how much time you're spending, the amount of attention that you're giving to content. They're all taking that in as data and they are pushing forward stuff that, Kim spent 15 minutes looking at, or 15 seconds looking at mattress ad. She wants a mattress. Let me start putting anything to do with mattresses out on this content. And so it really is very much manipulating the parts of your brain that are influencing, that are involved in attention and reward and decision making. It's all there to keep you there and to keep you there as long as possible because, again, they're data collecting and they're feeding you information and ads to keep you engaged.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
So there's a few studies, it's still pretty early days, where people are trying to collect data from people at a sort of shorter time scale. So maybe we would buzz you on your phone a few times a day and check up on what you're doing. Or if you're partnering with a social media platform or able to record the data from the platform, we can track things like your likes and your comments and posts. And so there's a handful of studies now that are able to show that when you get more likes, you report feeling a little bit better. And when you get fewer likes, you report feeling a little worse relative to yourself normally. So, you know, this kind of behavior, the reward-based stuff, everybody can relate to that. It sounds really compelling. The question that is really unresolved is, are there meaningful consequences for that, right? The fact that you spent a long time scrolling on your phone may be a fairly neutral experience. Maybe it's a problem. And when we're talking, you know, circling back to the addiction concept, if you're worried about it because everyone's telling you that your behavior is wrong, that's very different than having kind of an internal experience of this is distressing me. I am distressed by the amount of time I spend scrolling versus my mom is distressed by the amount of time I spend scrolling and that distresses me. So it's complicated.
Yeah, I read once about early curation of content for people, and a father got very angry because this company was giving pregnancy ads to his daughter, and the company's like, oh, we're really sorry, and then he talked to his daughter, and she was pregnant, so. Anyway, so even I will find myself, I'll admit it, I'm not going to raise their hands how many people find themselves scrolling too much. I'll admit that even I find myself sometimes endlessly scrolling, and a half an hour will go by, and I'll be so angry at myself for not catching it sooner. So what's going on in your brain when you just get stuck in this mode where you can't, either you don't realize what you're doing or you can't stop doing it?
That's a great question.
It's a great question. So as I've been alluding to, one of the things that social media and apps, gaming will do is it capitalizes on activation of a key circuitry in your brain known as the reward pathway. So this starts out, it's a tiny population of cells nestled deep in the middle of your brain. It's called the ventral tegmental area. For those of you that want the science, I see you nodding in front of me. I know you like the neuroscience.
BTM
fans. That is normally held silent, right? Like, it's a lot of inhibitory control over this VTA What happens is when we encounter highly salient, which is a very fancy neuroscience word to mean novel, new, interesting, could influence your survival. So highly salient stimuli, like food, sex, drugs, somebody's really interesting comedic reel that relates to your parenting skills, I don't know. It's going to disinhibit that PTA, and what that's going to do is send off signaling up into the forebrain of your, the very front part of your brain, and also areas of the brain that are involved in reward. So a key brain region known as the nucleus accumbens, when we get that dopamine signal to the nucleus accumbens, that's a, that feels very nice. At the same time, the area of the brain that's involved in decision-making, your prefrontal cortex, gets that information as well and says, oh, next time you want something feeling to feel good, this is what you need to do to get that feel-good feeling again. And your hippocampus is also informed, which tells you where you were when you were feeling that good feeling so that you can navigate to that region in the future. So all that reward circuitry is being activated. As Andrew was saying, maybe when you're getting likes, maybe when you're seeing content that you really like. Remember, a lot of this stuff is about that visual appeal. We're highly visual creatures as mammals, two eyes in front of our head. Everything is about our visual system. So lots of colors, brightness, sounds as well can be highly appetitive. So this is what's happening to kind of keep us there as well. The default mode network, which is that kind of constellation of brain circuits and regions that are there to keep us attentive, that's highly engaged, so it's keeping us attentive. At the same time, your prefrontal cortex over time is getting weakened. So anybody know, I have an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old. My 14-year-old in particular is very susceptible to, after long periods of scrolling, her ability to regulate her emotions decreases substantially. So I can tell when she's been online for long periods of time, she gets irritable, her emotions are much, much grouchier, because the parts of her brain that are involved in emotional regulation are being taxed. So that part of, those parts of your brain that are controlling your inhibitory impulses are kind of weakened the more that we're infinitely scrolling. So in a nutshell, lots of parts of your brain that are involved in attention, reward-seeking behaviors, motivated behaviors, and decision-making. Andrew, did you want to add anything to that?
Not much other than, like, that's going to be true for most reward-seeking kinds of behaviors. So that doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't seek reward. And just, I mean, for context, this is a really tricky problem because it's so facially obvious that being on your phone scrolling endlessly and, you know, getting stuck in these videos and things just feels like it should be wrong because it's so captivating. But the best estimates that we have from the research that, as I've said, has a lot of limitations, is that if we talk about measuring something like depression or anxiety, we can explain about 1% of it by accounting for the social media part of your life. So that's really insufficient, and it doesn't match with what you're seeing from the personal experience, either as yourself or as a parent or a friend, you know, watching people. I certainly have screen time rules for my kids, even though I know this research, because you can see behaviorally you need to, you know, place limits on all the kinds of things your children do at home. So there's an inconsistency that doesn't line up right with our experience.
Can I just follow up with a like, just to give us a sense of what a big effect might be? What is a behavior that has a large effect on depression, and what is that percentage?
So something like childhood adversity. So let's say like a traumatic childhood experience, something huge, right? Sexual abuse, or even something not that's traumatic experience, but like low socioeconomic status. There are various things that are pretty not debated. Those are bad. And then you'd be looking in the range of 25% to 50%, right? Those kinds of variables explain a lot of why some people have more significant depressive or anxiety symptoms than other people.
Okay, so aside from getting a non-human brain, what can someone do to avoid getting sucked into these things?
I don't know, because my brother He found this German Shepherd video on TikTok the other day. I have a German Shepherd, and there was this guy who does like a voiceover on German Shepherds, and it was really funny. And I said, I want you to send me every single one of these that you find. So I'm kind of like...
It's a kryptonite.
Yeah, so I think there's maybe nothing to be done. No, you
Well, I'm laughing because my Dee Maria was telling me that she's gotten sucked into these dogs pressing buttons that give them voices.
Yeah.
Hungry. Whoa. So that's the algorithm is speaking. So we all get sucked in, right? Okay. So if you truly like, and there is some joy, right? There's yeah. like, I feel like I'm bad cop, good cop here, but there is some joy to this, right? And sometimes after a long, hard day of work, it's fun to get fed this stuff and to relax. If you want to have some control over your social media behavior, there is some evidence-backed approaches. The best one, I don't know if anybody knows this, is put your phone on grayscale.
Grayscale.
So that's the one scientific thing that they found has been able to reduce their time that they're on social media. I don't know if anybody else has tried this, but the limits. Yep, sorry.
Why does grayscale work? What is it about grayscale?
Thank you, yeah. Great follow-up question. So, as I was saying, we're visual, right? We're visual, we're mammals, we like colors, lights, etc. Salient things that catch our attention, when we put it on grayscale, it grabs our attention less. So it activates those reward circuits less, those frontal attentional circuits less. So you find it's like eating gray food. Right? Would you want to eat a nice colorful sundae or a gray sundae?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, there you go. So what there is the option for is you can have these limits. Anybody ever try that? So you're like, I'm only allowed 30 minutes on Instagram. And then it comes up, it's like, your 30 minutes are up. Overturned. Denied. Right? So the problem is they rely on our cognitive skills, our ability for self-control, and we're terrible as a species for the most part, right? Our brains, like as children, really bad, as teens, really bad, as adults, slightly better.
Momentarily, right? Much worse.
Anyway, so the other option that I have for you is something called telegraphing. Anybody heard of this? So as you're scrolling, say out loud, I'm looking at videos of dogs pressing buttons. This is fascinating. I'm really liking this. So you're explaining your emotions and your reasoning out loud. And then there's research that shows that people are like, what am I doing? So that's one. And I know there's some parents in the room, so eventually you might get into like some tips for your teens and youth. And that has been one to even do that in front of your children is really important. Like just to show like, I'm just scrolling on Instagram right now because I'm just really tired and I just want to see what my friends are up to. So your kids can know your motivations and your thinking as you're engaging.
It sounds
very
defensive, though.
I swear to God, I'm not on it. And then the final one I have for you is only allow humans to send you notifications, okay? Don't allow the robots to send you notifications. So don't allow the Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, Netflix, take off all your push notifications so that literally the only things that you get on your phone are from humans. Somebody's text messaging you, phone calls, so that you don't get sucked in. Ooh, somebody just posted something fascinating, and then next thing you know, 3 hours later, you're on.
So I use a plugin called Social Fixer for Facebook on my desktop computers, and it stops my feed at 50, and you have to. It says, do you want to load more? And you have to click a button to load more.
Yeah.
So it's a really nice, like, oh, geez, all right, I've already looked at 50. It doesn't work on your phone, where most people do it. And I find that it's so much easier to get sucked in on the phone.
I'm good.
Yeah, you're good.
Okay, so that's what some of the things that individuals can do. I wonder if colorblind people don't get sucked in as much.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science and The Placebo Effect for making us feel better about our jokes, even if they might not be that funny. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. You can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Minding the Brain, and you can find us on YouTube at Minding the Brain Podcast. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.